Hello and welcome to the Ship.Energy podcast. This is Mark Williams broadcasting to you from Cambridgeshire in the UK. In April this year, the EU Fit for 55 package was approved in its latest format. And this is a bit of a confusing set of rules and regulations and recommendations. And in order to try and navigate our way through it, I'm delighted to say my guest today is Professor Simon Bourne. He's Professor of Shipping Law at the University of Swansea. He was appointed in September 2013, having been a reader at the University of Bristol Law School for many years before then. He studied law at Oxford and practiced in maritime law for several years before joining the academe. His research interests lie mainly in the field of shipping law, but also include the law of trusts and environmental law implications of the activities of multinational corporations in the developing world. Simon's book on shipping law has now run to 8 editions and is already well known to academics and students alike as pretty much the most approachable work on the subject. And he's now the author of the well-established practitioner's work, Summer Skill on Laytime. He has an extensive list of publications to his name, including International Trade and the Protection of the Environment and Human Rights and Corporate Wrongs, Closing the Governance Gap. He's also written and taught extensively on commercial law, trusts and environmental law. He's a member of the Institute of International Shipping and Trade Law, a university research centre within the School of Law, and he currently teaches at Swansea on the LLM in Carriage of Goods by Sea, Land and Air, Charter Parties Law and Practice, and International Corporate Governance. So we couldn't have a better guide to the latest developments in the EU's Fit for 55. Simon, welcome to the show. It's great to have you on.
Thank you, Mark. It's very good to be here and thanks for inviting me.
Well, we're delighted to have you on. The EU Fit for 55 package has just been approved in April, where we're recording this in May. And it's still a bit of a nest of vipers for a lot of people in shipping, trying to get their heads around exactly what it means and what the immediate effects and the longer term effects on shipping will be. And I know you spent a lot of time considering it, so we're delighted to get your views on that. But before we get into that, let's just, for those who don't know you, just introduce you and talk about your work.
I work at Swansea University in the College of Law, and we have a dedicated maritime research unit of which I'm a part called the Institute of International Shipping and Trade Law. And we have a blog, and I've contributed quite a few items to the blog to do with this very thing, the Fit for 55 agenda. And it is something which has been having twists and turns before. I think we've actually got a sort of a final form of most of the items in April of this year. I've been at Swansea for coming up for 10 years. Before that, I was at Bristol University for 24 years. My area is maritime law, but I've very much taken into my area things like climate change and its effect on shipping and autonomous vessels. So I haven't stood still just looking at paper bills of lading.
Sure, yes. I appreciate that. And we know that that you're one of the people at the forefront of research into this. So we're very grateful to you for taking the time for us. But what do you think are the immediate effects of this Fit for 55 package now?
Right. Well, so the Fit for 55 package has got various elements to it. I think the most immediate one is the amending of the 2003 directive on the establishing the emissions trading scheme in the EU, because as of the 1st of January of 2024, international shipping, vessels over 5,000 GRT, which are coming to a port within the jurisdiction of a member state or going from a port in that jurisdiction, they are going to be subject to the requirement to acquire carbon credit, emissions credits, and surrender them in accordance with the amount of carbon which those voyages has consumed. Now, there is a split between what is entire intra-EU voyages, where that's going to be 100% of their emissions have to be surrendered, and then voyages from outside or the EU coming into the EU and vice versa, where there's going to be a 50% requirement. But it's going to cost ship owners or demise charterers or ship managers. It's going to cost them really from next year. I mean, they're going to have to buy these allowances and they're going to have to surrender them. And that's going to be a cost, and there are going to be all sorts of issues to do with contractual issues as to how those costs are passed down the chain. And one of the interesting things about the amended directive is it actually provides for what I call a mandatory pass-through to time charterers of the cost of surrendering the allowances. And it requires member states to provide a statutory right for those surrendered allowances, the cost of the surrendered allowances, to be recovered from the time charterer under the polluter pays principle. Now, it always seems to me slightly strange in that I think shipping isn't just one party involved in this pollution. It's a commercial enterprise. I think the ship owner is as much involved in the pollution as the time charterer who's directing the trading to the EU, as to the original shippers who want their goods to get there. But the EU seems to think that it's the time charterer, because they've been able to direct the vessel to trade there, and they're paying for the fuel. So, it raises some very interesting questions, though, as between ship owner and time charterer. Contractually, if you haven't got a clause in your time charter similar to the BIMCO ETSA clause, which effectively pins everything, all the costs of ETS on the time charter, and it makes the time charterer actually have to buy the allowances and hand them over to the ship owner. If you haven't got a clause like that, I don't see that there's any contractual mechanism for recovery of those surrendered allowances. That is then going to set up a conflict between a ship owner sometime in the future under one of these charters which doesn't have a clause like the ETSA clause. They're going to say, OK, we're going to go to a court in a member state. I don't know which one. Maybe they will be able to choose a court in any of the member states, depending on what the national legislation looks like. And they will try and get their judgment against the time charterer. Then how do they enforce it? Is the time charterer then going to, are we then going to see anti-suit injunctions coming around? I think we have some potentially very interesting conflicts of law issues as to the position. If you get an arbitral award saying you're not going to have any liability to reimburse the ship owner for these costs, and yet you've got a judgment in, say, France, which is saying ship owner has got a right now to claim these costs back from the time charterer. I think that's something which is going to... I haven't seen much discussion of that, and it's something I'm actually going to give a presentation of when we have our annual colloquium in September at the IISTL. But I think that's going to be quite an issue coming up as between owners and charterers, and assuming that they can't come to some sort of amicable agreement about how these costs should be shared.
I've spoken to several ship owners about this and what they'll do with vessels that they have on time charter currently, and the time charter extends beyond January 2024. And the attitude at the moment is very much, well, we've agreed to agree. That we know this is coming, but we haven't got an agreement yet. We know we're going to have to insert a clause into the extant time charter party, but we haven't agreed what clause it will be, if it will be the BIMCO clause, and the time charterer hasn't agreed to it yet. And there aren't many months left for owners and time charterers to negotiate this, given that a large proportion of the fleet is actually out on time charter to operators.
Split it 50-50. I think that's the most sensible thing to do. But then the time charterer then has its own question about what about its pass through to maybe sub charterers or shippers. It will have to do a bit of contract contractual negotiation itself, although presumably this will be with new contracts. So that will be perhaps a bit easier, but it can't just end up, with one party. There needs to be some method of pushing this proportionately down the chain. And actually, one of the interesting developments I heard about at this, I went at the conference in Copenhagen, and again at a conference back in April in UCL, is this scheme called the Blue Visby scheme, where they're trying to develop a sort of almost like an interclub agreement pass-through arrangement for the costs and benefits, for example, of slow steaming.
That's long, yeah. How will the process work? The ship owner has to report the emissions, or has to report the fuel consumption, and the emissions are calculated from that.
Yes, and that is going to change because at the moment, under the existing EU MRV, 2015 Monitoring, Reporting and Verification Regulation, and also under the IMO's reporting regulation, it's carbon dioxide emissions, which is focused on. What is interesting is that is it next year or the year after? But very soon, the EU's measure is going to, the MRV is going to include methane and nitrogen dioxide. And I think from 2026, those emissions are going to come within the ETS. So, I mean, that's something to watch out for. And particularly with the in regard to LNG as a sort of replacement fuel for hydrocarbons, that is something to bear in mind. You're not going to get a pass through just because you've now gone over to LNG. What about those methane slip? And of course, it's going to be calculated on a well to wake basis. It's not just tank to tank, it's well to wake. So
it's definitely going to complicate the cost of operating an LNG powered ship, isn't it?
It is, yes.
Yeah. But on the process, so the ship owner has to report via the MRV the emissions for the previous calendar year. I think by the end of March, is it?
I think that's right, yes. Yep.
And then the EU gets a couple of months to work out what the bill should be.
That's right.
And then when does the ship owner have to pay the bill?
I think it's at the end of the calendar year. He's got to they've got to buy the necessary allowances, the credits, which you can either do on the primary market or the secondary market. But you've got to buy them, and then you've got to surrender them.
If the time charterer is buying the fuel.
Yes.
Then the owner is dependent on the time charter to forward the fuel receipts in good order in order to make the report to the EU.
Yes, although that to some extent is something which already has to happen because of the reporting obligations under both the IMO measure and the EU measure. So I don't think that's going to be disruptive. I think it's going to get a bit more disruptive with when you start having to report the methane emissions and the nitrogen dioxide emissions, which is going to come fairly soon, actually.
Yes, just a couple of years down the line, yeah.
That's right.
Will sulfur dioxide emissions be included, do you know?
Well, that's an interesting point. No, they won't. I'm going to be controversial here. Sulfur dioxide is actually, I think, has a net cooling effect. So if you've got if you've got heavy fuel oil, the standard bunkers, it produces sulfur dioxide, which is bad for health, et cetera, et cetera. On the other hand, sulfur dioxide going up into the atmosphere has a cooling effect. And indeed, there have been things about geoengineering, about actually putting sulfur up into the atmosphere, which is something which ships were quite good at doing before. So sulfur dioxide is not, I mean, I don't think there's going to be any change with the sulfur, the sulfur cap and what we all went through. Got very worried about as we were coming up to the 1st of January 2020. So I don't think anything's going to change there.
Okay, so so if you have a scrubber fitted vessel, and you're paying at the moment about $450 a ton for your 3.5% sulfur fuel oil, and then you've got to pay your emissions carbon allowances, you've got to surrender your carbon allowances, you might be cheaper running a vessel on heavy fuel oil than you would be on running a vessel on more expensive, for instance, biofuels or biofuel blends that have a lower carbon dioxide output.
I think the economics might sort of come to that way. And actually, one of the things I'm interested about with scrubbers is once you've scrubbed your sulfur dioxide, where is it disposed? Where does it go? I mean, this is a wider thing. For example, we talk about carbon capture, and there have been some suggestions that you might be able to fit carbon capture devices on vessels, which sounds great, but there's the next step is you've captured that carbon. Where are you going to store it?
Yes, can you recycle it into synthetic fuels, or sequester it and push it underground into defunct oil and gas wells under the ocean is one of the plans for the North Sea, isn't it?
Well, there's also some suggestion that you might be able to sort of turn it into some sort of basalt and then grind it down, and it can be used as fertilizer to put carbon back into the soil. I don't know. There are various suggestions, but I think it's all a bit sort of iffy at the moment as to what's going to happen. It needs to be considered, particularly by legislators. You've got to think about what's going to be the end result of all this captured material.
So we've sort of covered how time charters and owners and time charterers were going to have to work around each other to fit for 55. What about the renewal of the fleet? So we've got about 60,000 ocean-going ships and about 40,000 estuarine and riverine and offshore vessels floating around with IMO numbers on them, all of which need to be refitted or replaced with something that emits low enough levels of carbon dioxide to meet the 2030 or 2050 emissions standards. So that's 100,000 new ships to build in 25 years, roughly. It's about 4,000 ships a year. Do you think shipbuilding contracts are going to have to alter to encompass these new policies? Or do you think that if a ship owner has a shipbuilding contract currently in hand, say for a series of ships, do you think they're likely to want to alter that contract?
Well, the question really is, what is the alternative? Is the fueling of that ship? What alternative? How are you going to alter the fueling of your new ships so as to decarbonize? And the problem, I think, for smaller vessels, it may well be feasible to use hydrogen. I think there are already hydrogen ferries. It's probably going to be feasible to use batteries. I think, the Yara Birkeland, that first proto-autonomous vessel, is battery run. And, if you're doing very small runs, I think that is going to be an option. And although one of the things legislators need to think about is with batteries, well, you're going to get that power. How is that power generated? I mean, I suppose that I'm thinking particularly the thing about cold ironing, which is part of the EU's proposal, electrification when you're at dock. Well, is the electricity coming into your dock vessel, is that being produced by renewable?
Yeah, is it fossil fuel energy or renewable energy? Yeah.
Exactly. And if you're talking about hydrogen, how has that been made? Is it blue hydrogen, black or grey hydrogen, or is it green hydrogen? But from the point of view of alternative fuels for, say, container vessels, I think Maersk has got into the idea of is it biomethane? Is it, they're going to go.
So some biomethane and some methanol. So biomethane for their LNG powered ships. CMA CGM are doing that as well. And then methanol is the next fuel along, which has a greater reduction in carbon dioxide compared to LNG. But of course, a lot of methanol is made by reforming methane.
Yes, you have to look at how various things of these fuels. One is the process of by which they are made, which is part of the Wells Wake inquiry. Secondly, the availability of those fuels. And I think the thing with Musk's proposal is there may be a shortage of sources for making this.
Yes, there's certainly not enough green methanol or biomethanol to fuel all of Musk's vessels yet.
And the third thing, which I think ties in with another part of the Fit for 55 proposal, is having adequate bunkering facilities for these new fuels. And I think it's the AFIR directive, the Alternative Fuels Infrastructure, which is saying that fairly soon there's got to be, within the European Union, bunker facilities for LNG, but also for hydrogen and ammonia. And that's something which has been recently added into that. Initially, it was just going to be LNG, but hydrogen and ammonia have also been put in. So you've got a lot of different things to think about. And I wouldn't like to be in the position of thinking about my new ship and thinking, but what do I go with? Because this is going to get increasingly regulated and over the next 10 years.
Yeah, and I think the issue for the ports and for the bunker supplies, of course, will be they're going to have to generate a lot of redundant capacity, at least in the short term, because they might make the ammonia, the hydrogen, the methanol available along with the fuel oil and the LNG and the cold ironing facilities for plugging in electrified vessels. But not every ship is going to use all of those different fueling sources. So it may only use one or it may only use two of them. So you end up with redundant capacity, which is not profitable.
I think you have to have state intervention and you have to think this is important. I mean, like the fact that, for example, Norway with electric vehicles seems to, for a while, to have had state subsidies. I think they've ended now, but I think that they got some sort of exemption from the state aid rules. And you can't leave this to the market. I hope that one of the things the Innovation Fund will perhaps do is actually to provide, is to use funds from ETS to develop this initially redundant capacity.
Yes, to develop that. Well, that would be a good place for this proposed Ocean Fund to go. But we were talking earlier and you were mentioning maybe this Ocean Fund isn't going to happen now.
It's going to happen. It's going to be subsumed in the Innovation Fund because there's a certain amount of new allowances which are going to be created to take account of the extension of the ETS to shipping. And I think of those, the revenues from, I think it's 20 million of the allowances, I think that's about 15% of the new allowances, the revenue from that is going to be directed to ocean, what would have been Ocean Fund purposes, which is sort of decarbonising maritime transport. I'm just trying to have a look at my notes and actually see what specifically was said, but it's quite wide, and it's talking about institutions of the EU doing this. It doesn't actually specify who's actually going to be doing this, and particularly what's going to happen. But I would say that providing bunker facilities, what's under the Alternative Fuel Directive, would actually be quite an important part of that. And I think also funding the ability to do cold ironing at ports in the EU. And hey, let's make sure that electricity comes from renewable sources.
Every port is going to want its own offshore wind farm. At least they're located on the coast. At least most of them are. So the vessel operator is is still going to be at the mercy of the charterer. They're going to be under the command of the charterer to turn up under whatever the regime is as fast as possible within the Laycan to deliver the cargo. But there's been a lot of discussion about altering charter parties to replace these due dispatch clauses with voyage optimization clauses. So instead of hurry up and wait, sort of take your time and minimize fuel burn in order to still meet the Laycan. What's your take on this change? Have you done any work into this?
I had a look at some of the virtual, there's virtual arrival clauses and there's some voyage optimization clauses which are directed at voyage charters. And I think, what is the sort of commercial incentive for a voyage charterer to agree to these clauses? I mean, that's the problem. And there's, I think it can only happen, I think, if the ship owner is then going to say, well, you know, I'm going to be trading into the EU. I'm going to pay these costs. I'm going to have to increase my freight rate. And then the voyage charterer might think, well, you know, maybe a bit of voyage optimization is gives me a lower freight rate, so I'll agree to the clause. But then you have to look at how that works with your own contracts with people who want, you know, the goods to get to the port as soon as possible. So that's I think freight rates will go up. Ship owners will have to put up freight rates or time charterers.
Simon, we're running to the end of our time, but thank you so much for taking the time out of your schedule to speak to us today. We're delighted to have you on the show.
It's been a great pleasure, Mark. Thank you very much.
Thanks, and thank you to everybody out there in listener land, and tune in again soon for another episode of the Ship.Energy podcast. This is Mark Williams from Cambridgeshire in the UK signing off.
And Simon Bourne from Swansea University. Thank you.